Welcome to the Midlife Masculine Podcast. I am Dhruv Sethi. As men, we reach an inflection point in our lives where we question our achievements. Despite societal expectations and our own credentials, many of us feel unfulfilled. I have lived in three countries, built a career in finance, achieved several academic and professional qualifications, but I know there's still more to life, just like most men today. Join me as I invite guests to share wisdom so that we men become self-sovereign in mind, body, and spirit, all with a spiritual undertone. Welcome to another episode of the Midlife Masculine Podcast. My guest today is Corey Rosenke. Corey is an author, pastor, communicator, and a tenacious pursuer of truth. Corey is both the concept pioneer and the foremost authority on the cravings of the soul. Through session, song, workshop, and manuscript, he is dedicated to the pivotal work of connecting hungry souls to the joy of the Maker. Welcome, Corey.
Dhruv, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
It's great to have you. This podcast, there's an undertone of spirituality, faith. Ultimately, it's about getting my listeners to just broaden their horizon, to ultimately get out of the matrix in mind, body, and spirit. And I'm so very happy to have you here. So Corey, perhaps my first question is quite existential, and that is, what is the soul and what is it good for?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking the question. I think it's one of the most important questions, to be honest, in our modern age. We have come to believe in this modern world that we are nothing but brains and bodies, that we are just, organic robots, and that there's nothing else to it. And nothing could be further from the truth. We, more than a brain or a body, I believe we are souls. Not only do I believe that, but I believe that all of us at some level intuitively are aware of that fact. And yet we live in a world who has forgotten that. And in so doing, we've forgotten who and what we are. And so your soul is the core of who you are. It's the seed of your personality. It is the root of your deepest ambitions. The biggest driving force in life as you decide which way to go, what choice to make, is not coming from brain chemicals or some sort of a psychological mechanism. It is birthed much deeper in the soul. And so ultimately, the soul is what I often will refer to as our non-biological selves. And it is the core of who you are. It is the attribute that best defines you. And as far as what it's good for, your whole life is spent trying to satisfy the needs of your soul. And the reason why we see so many people today unhappy, even though they have all these possessions, is because of the fact they have been working so hard to satisfy the desires of the brain and the body. Those are important desires, by the way, but they are not the core of who we are. And so they're working to satisfy the brains the needs of their brain and their body, and our souls are starving to death. And ultimately, I believe that that is the reason we see the friction in the world today, because we've forgotten what it means to be human.
And do you believe that when the soul enters the body, it already knows what it wants to do, or does it enter with a blank sheet of paper and it's up to us to create our destiny?
Yeah, I believe that our souls are the great leveler, in that our souls are looking for the same thing. And that has been, I'm glad you asked that question, Dhruv, because that has really been my deepest desire and the thing that I want to communicate the most, is that you have a soul. Now, most people are going to say, yeah, I know that, I'm aware of that, though they're not living like it. You know, that's obviously the challenge. On one hand, we know we have a soul, and yet we're not living like we know we have a soul. But as far, the next piece of information that's important is, you are a soul, and that soul is looking for something. So when you think of your body as an example, let's look at it this way. We feel hunger and thirst, right? Those are biological cravings. And these biological cravings are designed and intended to then propel us towards nutrients, right? Just think of it. If I didn't have the sensation of thirst, if that craving was, that biological craving did not exist in me, I would forget to drink water, probably. And I'd be dead in 4 days because I can't survive without water, right? And so that thirst feeling, that thirst craving, that sense that we have of it is actually for a purpose. It says, hey, go get what you need to get to survive. And so we go and we drink that water. Our souls are the same. Our souls have very distinct cravings. And whether we've been fully aware of it or not, these cravings have been propelling all of us through life and time. I always say every generation, every sexual orientation, doesn't matter where in history you were born, we're all looking for the same things, and we've always been looking for the same things. It's only when we start thinking strictly biological that we become so divided, right? That things become about racism and sexism, because I look at you and I judge you by how you look, and you judge me by how I look, and these chasms form between us. But in our souls, that is the great link. That is the place we are connected. We are all looking for the same thing. And so when you realize that your soul doesn't just exist, but your soul is the core of who you are, and it's looking for something, it behooves us to finally identify what it is it's looking for, what it is we are looking for. And that is what I'm all about, trying to help people come to that realization and kind of have that light switch. Aha, now I know what I'm looking for.
Do all souls ultimately look for the same thing?
Yes, I believe so. I believe that's what the evidence shows at its root. Now, we, for example, will look for satisfaction in different places, but we're looking for the same thing. So let me give you a quick rundown. So I've written a book called The Magnetic Heart of God, Understanding the Five Cravings of Your Soul. And so what I put forth in the book, of course, in much more detail than we can unpack in a podcast, but is that our souls have five distinct cravings. And these cravings did not evolve into being, nor can they devolve out of being. That's to say, we cannot suppress them. They are the core of who we are. And so these five cravings are, I'll just run through them quickly. Security is one of them. Every human being on earth needs to feel secure. That's not just a biological craving, that's a craving in the soul. And I break down the security craving into two parts. We need to feel physically secure, which is what, you know, we often call our survival instinct. And we need to feel relationally secure. That is to say, we need to know that our hearts are safe in the hands of those who hold them. And we can literally be driven to a point of madness if that security fails. So we're looking for security, every single human being on earth. Identity. It's this craving that no other creature on earth is looking for, but humanity, every single one of us, again, it doesn't matter your ethnicity, you know, where you're from, what time you were born. We all need to know. I always say identity asks four symbiotic questions. Who am I? Why am I? Do I have value? Do I have purpose? And once again, we can have all the security in the world, but if we don't know who we are, we don't have peace. It's part of being human. And then the third one is security, identity, independence. You know, I will break that down into two parts. The part of independence, one part is freedom. We all need to have some sense of autonomy. Maybe not total autonomy, but we need some sense of autonomy. That's why things like prison, as an example, are actually punishments, because they're confining, right? That's why we don't like it when someone, some culture or some media source or some government official tells us how and what we have to think, right? Because we want freedom. And then the other part of the independence craving is the craving for individuality. We need to know that we are distinct, right? And that, to a certain degree, ties in with the identity craving. I need to know that I am distinct. We're different from each other. And as much as we want to celebrate our similarities, we also want to understand that there's a difference. And if we don't have a sense that we are distinct, we soon feel redundant, that there's no purpose to our existence. We need to feel like we are individuals. We can't just be part of some massive collective. Fourthly, our craving for significance. Every human being on earth needs to know that they are special in some way, that we aren't just distinct, but that we are special. We aren't just set apart, but we are set above. And for some people, they need to be the strongest guy in the gym. For someone else, they need to know that they make the best apple pie. You know, we all come up with our metric. We make up our own metric, right? But ultimately, we need to be convinced that we are special. We are significant in some way. And then fifthly, innocence. We all need to know that it's inherent within us that we are not just not bad, but that we are in fact good, that there is a righteousness aspect to us. And when you think of it this way, basically every argument you've ever had or any offense you've ever taken happened because you felt that someone directly or indirectly accused you of wrongdoing or wrong thinking. And your response is one of two things generally. Either you're going to fight, because you can't have someone accuse you, and you're going to, what I always often call the righteousness battle begins. I accuse you, you know, you say, Corey, you left your socks on the floor. I should just say, you're right. I'm sorry. I left my socks on the floor. I said I wouldn't do that. Instead, I go, oh yeah? Well, you left the bathroom in a mess, right? I don't need to feel totally innocent, but I need to feel like I'm more innocent than you. And this affects every marriage, every relationship. I believe it's at the root of what we call cancel culture in the world today, is this righteousness metric. And when we get in contact with someone who makes us feel guilty, we either have to fight or flee, because we can't be around someone who does that, right? And so those are the five cravings that we are all pursuing. Now, I believe that we're all the same. It is true of all of us. It is inherent within us. It is designed within us this way. However, what we do is we pursue them in different ways.
That's very interesting. And it is broadly in line with Maslow's hierarchy of needs as well. And just a reminder of what it is in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, at the bottom of the pyramid, you have the physiological needs, and a level above that is safety and security. One level above that is a need for love and belonging, and then above that is self-esteem. That's probably where we have that need to distinguish ourselves from everyone else. And at the very top is the self-actualization. So not an expert on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but broadly speaking, they seem to be quite aligned, the five cravings that you described and the pyramid of Maslow.
Absolutely. In fact, it is almost a spooky, if I could use that word, how this, I don't want to call it simplification, because it took a lot of work and a lot of study and a lot of observation to bring us to this understanding. But yeah, it is amazing when you realize how everything comes back down to these five cravings. And here's the thing, when you finally know what you're looking for, that's powerful. It actually gives you the opportunity for success. And that's why I'm so passionate about talking to people. People of all different faiths, all different backgrounds, all different, you know, ideas on how the earth was formed, right? Whatever people's background is, I want to bring this information. More than a brain or a body, you are a soul. Not only are you our soul, but this is what you're looking for. And now that you know what you're looking for, you can understand yourself. You can understand your neighbor. You can understand that politician that you love and that politician that you revile, because you can now see them and say, aha, I know what they're looking for. They're looking for it in a different way than I would, but I know what they're looking for. And then that gives me the opportunity to understand them. Understanding gives me the opportunity to have patience with them, or to love them, or to negotiate with them, because I now know where they're coming from.
What proof is there that mankind has a soul?
Well, I think the first one is what we kind of already went over. I always say, you're your own best evidence, right? In that we all intuitively know that we have souls. C.S. Lewis once said that cravings do not exist unless satisfaction for those cravings also exists, right? And you can give several examples. You can say, well, a baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. If there had been no such thing as the biological craving of hunger, of food, I mean, if there was no such thing as food, we would not have developed a biological craving for it. But we as human beings have, as I mentioned, these non-biological cravings, these cravings that are deeper than psychology, they are deeper than neuroscience. We desire, it's a must inside of us to understand the distinction between a moral right and a moral wrong. And we may argue over what those are, but we have within us a desire to understand them. That's not a biological craving, that's a non-biological craving. We crave the eternal. And for many people, we crave God. These cravings would not exist unless satisfaction for those cravings also exists. Finish that off. So we have this personal internal evidence that we have souls. But then here's the big one, and this is as scientific a fact as you can get. When you think of it, virtually every culture throughout all of time came to the same conclusion. Now, again, this is a very scientific fact. When you think of it this way, every culture came to the same conclusion that we exist beyond biology. The awareness of our souls, the awareness of our non-biological selves, did not spread across the globe. Like, for an example, the Europeans who believed in a soul, when they landed at Plymouth Rock in America, they came to a people who already believed in the soul. Now, they had a different religion, but they already had an awareness of their soul, that they existed beyond biology. You know, when the Romans landed their legions north of the White Cliffs of Dover, the Romans believed in a soul. But when they came to Britain, they came to a people who already believed in the soul. Now, the Romans tried to bring their own religion, their own faith structure, but they were coming to people who already believed in the soul. Africa, the continent of Africa, long before it was subject to any side of kind of outside influence, believed in a soul. So when you think that every culture came to the same conclusion without coercion, right, without some messenger going out to convince everyone, that is as scientific a fact as you can get.
I never thought of that. You're right. All religions or faiths in one form or another believe or have believed that there is a soul, like the pagan faiths in the British Isles and in the Native Americans in North America, and a lot of cultures in the African continent, and obviously the South Asian Indian cultures as well, the Dharmic cultures. They all believed in souls, and not only that, also the animals, plants had their own souls as well. You're a pastor, and there's one phrase in Christianity which sort of rings very true with me, but I've never really understood what that means. So perhaps you can explain that before we move on to the next segment. And that is, what does it mean to
to be made in the image of God. I like the sound of it, but I don't exactly know what it is. Could you explain that?
Thank you. I think this is a super important question to answer. And I will tell you that even in Christian circles, it has not been well answered. It has been left ambiguous. But when it comes to this, that question, what does it mean to be made in the image of God? We need to have a clear answer. And I believe that is that we have been custom designed to live in connection with our Maker. That's what it means to be created in the image of God. We were designed to live in connection with Him. And that is an awesome thought. And once again, it's an awesome thought that I believe is privileged uniquely to mankind. That it is not true of the gazelle, you know, or the golden eagle, right? Or the mouse. But we have been designed to live in connection with the sovereign of the universe. That is an awesome thought. And the reason I call my book The Magnetic Heart of God, Understanding the Five Cravings of Your Soul, has very much to do with this. I believe that God placed these five cravings within us for the purpose of drawing us back to Him. Just like thirst draws us to water, hunger draws us to, you know, food and nutrients, that the cravings inside of us, security, identity, independence, significance, and innocence, were put there for the purpose of drawing us back to our Maker. My point being this, there is nothing on earth that can fully satisfy all of your cravings. For that, we have to live in connection with our Maker. And so I believe that our Maker put these cravings inside of us for the purpose of drawing us back to connection. This force that is constantly trying, while we have this magnet within us drawing us to our Maker, there is also this force that is seeking to divert those cravings into other places where at the end of the day, we can't find satisfaction. Just think of this. Elon Musk, I saw an interview with him a while ago, the richest man who's ever lived so far as we know. I saw an interview with him and the interviewer asked him, "Are you happy?" And Elon Musk paused for a moment and you could tell he was having a moment of introspection and he said, "I don't think many people would want to be me." And of course, we all lose our minds. It's like, how is this possible? Here is a man who there is nothing he cannot have. There is nothing on this earth that he cannot have. And yet he's come to realize that there's nothing there. So much so that I would even say this, he's looking to the stars. You know, the two richest men on earth, who has the space programs today? It is the two richest men on earth, Bezos, right? And Musk. They literally have everything the world could possibly offer them. It's not enough. So they look to the stars. And the truth of the matter is they're not going to find it there either. They got to find it in here.
That's for sure. And just on a side note, I would not go to Mars or whatever planet these people want to colonize. Because once you go to one of these planets, let's assume that it does materialize, you're going to be dependent on somebody for air, water, supplies, all of that stuff. And as it is in modern society, we are already dependent on few people at the top, whether the banks, governments, the World Health Organization, World Economic Forum. I don't want to be dependent on even fewer people on another planet. So yeah, that's just a side note. I want to chime in on what you said about we were not created to be completely independent from God. That does resonate with me. But I have a thought that the relationship our souls have with God is that of an overindulgent parent that allowed humanity to be created and experience the joys of life, highs and lows of emotions and all types of experiences. And God, as an overindulgent parent, said, like, go on, enjoy yourself, or go on and experience this, but never forget who I am. And so you're always sort of connected, and perhaps that's what the soul is, that tells you what's right from wrong. And God also gave us free will so that we could make the right decision based on what our souls deep inside wants and doesn't want. And it's that free will that really determines how, whether we're getting closer or further away from God. So that is a thought that sort of stuck with me for some time now, overindulgent parents.
I very much agree with you. Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I also think that that is why our Maker put the cravings inside of us, was because of free will. So because we can choose the right path, or inherent within free will, you can choose the wrong path, right? And so the reason that our Maker can be so generous and say, I release you, right, to be free people with a free will, he still in love put those five cravings within us like a beacon that always seeks to pull us home, right? So it's like, while we have the free will to wander where we want, there is always within us, you know, by God's grace, you know, these cravings that keep us tethered. Tethered is probably the wrong word, but keep us linked with our maker. And they never allow us to go too far away. It doesn't mean we always return, because we often don't, but it's like that great link that keeps us connected.
So as a person who's not from a Christian background, from my own education and that of my listeners as well, what role does the devil have in this?
Well, so as far from a Christian standpoint, and the view of the devil would be this. The devil is not the legitimate adversary of God. Oftentimes people think there's this battle between good and evil. I believe that God is omniscient, which means he's everywhere at once, right? He's all powerful, right? And the devil is not. So he's not a contender. But because we have free will, the devil is the tempter. And so when I talk about sin or the sin nature, I believe that that is very closest connected with the devil. Because the devil, from a Christian standpoint, and I believe from the generic standpoint in the world now, his goal is ultimately to rob you of joy, to bring chaos. Well, God wants you to have peace and be whole. Satan plays the role of someone coming in to try to blow that up. And so he promises all sorts of good things, but ultimately he's trying to lure us away. So, you know, I look at it this way. So because you brought that up, we talk about the devil and the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, he's represented as the serpent, right? And so when we think of the Garden of Eden, we think of a place of perfect bliss and happiness. Adam and Eve lived in a state of perfect security. There was no death. There was no disease. They were made in the image of God, strong in identity. They were independent. The scripture says, if you're talking again from the Christian viewpoint, that God released them to steward the earth, and they named the animals. And the scripture specifically says, whatever they named them, that's what they were called. God wasn't micromanaging them. He released them to independence. They experienced significance. They were the apple of God's eye, the crown jewel of creation. And of course, sin had not entered the world, so they were innocent. It was the perfect place. And then the serpent comes in, and what does he do? He says to Eve, did God really say you can't eat from that tree? Right, which I believe is what the serpent or the devil does to this very day, right? Did God really say you shouldn't do that? Did God really say that, you know, running off on your spouse, sleeping around is bad? Did God really say that murder is wrong? You know, he asks these questions. And in the case of the biblical text, Eve answers correctly. She says, yeah, God said, don't do that. Right. And then he says the next question. She says, yeah, God said, if we eat from this tree, we will die. And the serpent says, you will not die. He contradicts what God said is truth and reality. And so as far as the devil and the role he plays, that's the exact role that he plays today. He's constantly trying to contradict God, constantly trying to question God's legitimacy.
And what is Satan's or the devil's incentive to rob us of that joy and take us further away from God?
Yeah. Well, ultimately, I believe it's bitterness and rage. It's the height of delusion. If you read the scripture as to kind of the devil's downfall, you know, God created the devil, but not as the devil, but as one of the most powerful and beautiful of all angels and creations. And then we find in the biblical text and in the book of Ezekiel and Isaiah, for that matter, the two main passages, how it says Satan decided he wanted to be like the Most High. He said, I will ascend to the stars of heaven. And again, he's not a legitimate contender, right? God's omnipresent. He's all powerful. He's all knowing. Satan's not. He's not a legitimate contender. So he's cast out of heaven. And so he's now lurking around sulking. And what do people who lurk around and sulk and get offended do? Well, they try to destroy the good creation of the one who they now hate. And in Satan's case, it's God, right? And so just think of that. So Adam and Eve, remember, they existed in this perfect state. Satan did not offer them anything they didn't already have. But what he told them was he said, you will not die. In other words, well, he says, you will not die. And then what he goes on to say, he says, because God knows when you eat from this, you're going to become like him. Now, just think of it. That's exactly what Satan's always wanted. Back in Ezekiel and Isaiah, he wanted to become like God. And so what he does is he questions God's integrity. And in so doing, he he collapses Eve's security in God and her identity in God. And then he says to them, you will be great and free. You will be like God. So then he offers them counterfeit independence and significance. And so they believe Satan and they lose their innocence. It all comes crashing down in the Garden of Eden. And we've been doing, you know, from the Christian standpoint, again, we've been doing that ever since. We're expelled from the garden, looking for security, identity, independence, significance, and innocence apart from our maker. And it doesn't work.
No, thanks for the explanation. One of the reasons why I am quite interested in this topic is because you see more and more mainstream artists, singers, performers sort of make symbolic gestures to sort of call Satan and like act, big artists like Rihanna, Doja Cat. It's so strange and it's so prevalent and mainstream now to sort of make these symbols and sort of refer to Satan in their lyrics. It's just up in our face now. It's everywhere. So it is a bit worrying. And that's the reason why I asked the question.
Yeah, it is very prevalent in our world today to either do one of two things. To do what you mentioned, to actually embrace evil, right? And the symbols of evil, like AKA Satan and the devil, whatever. Or to ultimately try to imagine ourselves as God ourselves, or as our own God. Right. And that is ultimately, I think, that's that inner rebellion that I mentioned, that fatal fantastic element, as it's mentioned in philosophy, right? That continues to just, you give us something beautiful, we'll wreck it. that's what humanity does. And we've proven it throughout all of time. It's inherent within us when we are disconnected from our maker.
Yeah, for sure. We digress quite a bit, actually, but it's all interesting stuff, and I'm enjoying it. And that reminds me of that Michelangelo's painting. I think it's called Creation of Adam, where God is reaching out with the fingers fully stretched just to touch Adam. But Adam is sort of leaning back very reluctantly, stretching his arm, but not really stretching his finger. But God is trying his best to touch Adam's finger.
I love the way you describe that, because it's so true. I mean, obviously it's just Michelangelo's painting, but in that you see a determination on God's face in a reaching out, and on Adam's, you see this casual
reluctance,
reluctance. Exactly. Right. And I believe that is such a true picture.
Yeah. I do like that painting. It's very, very powerful. And I want to move on to the last segment, where you do say that the world is falling apart. What do you mean by that? And why is it falling apart?
It's falling apart in that, as I mentioned, we've been told for thousands of years that if you would just have enough money, if you could have enough freedom, if you could have enough sex, you know, if you could determine your own existence on your terms, I want to live here, I'm going to do this, I'm going to enjoy this. If you could just have that, you'll have peace and happiness. And then, of course, on top of that has been, if you would just get educated, that's a big thing in the world today too. Right? If we could just get everybody, quote unquote, educated, you know, we'll be able to live this Plato-like utopian existence, you know, that Plato always talked about and wished for. And ours is a generation that has, like I said, more prosperity, more education, more comfort, more leisure, more freedoms than any generation in the history of the world. And yet, along with that, we are sad, we are depressed, we are confused, we are angry. There is beneath the surface of our culture this building rage. There's a tension. I can say this, I'm not exactly sure what it's like in Britain, but in America and both the United States and Canada, there is this tension under the surface of culture that is just vibrating. People are frustrated, they are angry, and this in the midst of unprecedented prosperity. Why did that happen? It's because we've been looking for peace and happiness in all the wrong places. We have been looking strictly to the biological. And to your listeners out there, right, I would just, like the prodigal son and like the father, I'm sure, said to the prodigal son, right, I would just caution you. I'm not saying a diploma is a bad thing. It's a great thing. But don't let it be your identity. Don't let it be the source of your security, because it will let you down. For that matter, I often say this. Think of it this way. Because our cravings of our soul are non-biological cravings, they cannot be satisfied in biological sources. However, and Dhruv, this is important to make. So even if someone is listening and they're like, you know what, sounds too religious to me, I'm not interested in religion. Let me just take that away for a moment. If when you understand the cravings of the soul, you understand what your spouse is looking for. You understand what your boss is looking for. You understand what you're looking for. So absolutely, if you are in a relationship with someone and you want that relationship to thrive, you are going to have to reflect security, identity, independence, significance, and innocence to that person. If you're in a relationship with someone and you don't make them feel safe, or if you're making them feel guilty, or if you're making them feel small, that relationship will fall apart. Which is why the cravings of the soul are ultimately why most people want to get married, because they're looking to have those cravings satisfied in a relationship with someone else. And that's the reason people get divorced, because they're like, oh, I didn't get satisfied here, so I'm out of here. I got to go, maybe this person made me feel secure, but they also constantly made me feel guilty, and I can't live in an environment like that. So if you're wise, you will reflect these cravings to your spouse. You will reflect them in the workplace, because ultimately, if you are in your job and your boss sees you as someone who brings security, identity, independence, significance, and innocence to the workplace, you will climb that corporate ladder. But if you threaten any of those things in the workplace, you'll be out on your rear end, or at least you won't be advanced in the company. So even detached from any type of faith or existential viewpoint, these cravings will revolutionize your life when you realize what you're looking for, what other people are looking for.
Yeah, for sure. And on that as well, the need for safety and security, if I was to compare it to the Maslow's hierarchy of needs as well, it's one of the lower needs. And we obviously want to go above that particular need. And to the question as to what's the difference between animals and humans, there are many things that can be said about that. But one of, just on the point that you said, one of the things we can say is the difference is that the animalistic nature wants to satisfy the lower chakras, which all in essence are biological, whereas the human needs to satisfy the lower chakras, which are the biological needs, but beyond that as well, the upper chakras, which are much more esoteric, metaphysical, and much more about being connected to the all-knowing, to universe, to God. So yeah, very valid point there, Corey. Thanks for that. And this has been very insightful, Corey, and we're reaching the end. And I always have a section towards the end for my listeners so that they can have some takeaways and just sort of think about things in their own time or read up on things. So what few takeaways can you give to my listeners so that they can broaden their horizon and just think a bit beyond the biological needs?
Well, I would try to remind them of this. You are not the reflection in the mirror. That's not what defines you. You aren't defined by the number on the weigh scale. You aren't defined by the diploma on your wall. You are a soul designed to live in connection with your maker. You are so much more than those things. And Dhruv, I think the frustrating part, I don't want to use the word frustrating so much, but what makes this, I believe, a long-term mission that I'm on is because we can hear this. Your listeners, for example, are hearing this. And there is a spark in them that knows it's true. But the problem is, then we're going to wake up tomorrow morning and we're going to go look for peace and happiness in all the same failed places. It's that fatal, fantastic element that I mentioned inside of us. And so if I could leave that piece of advice with your listeners, is just to start off by recognizing what you are. You are valuable beyond biology. And so for me, what I'm hoping for is that at some point in this conversation, your listeners will experience some type of revelation where they will say, this is true. And then it will inspire them to do something about it. That's important to me. I'm also a transformational coach. I coach teams and individuals and stuff. Of course, coaching is when someone identifies where they're at in life and they want to get somewhere. And a coach's job is to help them kind of reach that goal. But at the end of the day, you have to do something about it. See, that's the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is revelation. When you gain a new knowledge, you gain a new revelation about something. It's like, ah, right? I understand this thing now. Wisdom is now the correct use of revelation. And a lot of us are knowledgeable people, but we struggle to take that step towards wisdom, right? So the knowledgeable person looks at the sky and says, ah, because I've gained this knowledge. I've had this revelation. I know that when the clouds look like that, when the birds are flying in this direction, when there's this dampness in the air, it's going to be a windy, rainy day tomorrow. I have that knowledge. Wisdom then brings in the lawn furniture, puts a tarp over things that need to be covered. And so what I would not want for your listeners is to listen to us have this conversation today and gain revelation, but not yet be willing to take that step to do something about it. If you will begin looking, if you will allow yourself to look beyond biology, to satisfy these cravings, it will change your life. And as I mentioned, I'm not trying to shove my faith down your throat. What I want to do is get you pointed in the right direction, so that you have at least the opportunity for success.
That's very valuable. Thank you for that, Corey. Where can people find you?
Yeah, great. Thank you. For anyone who is interested, the best place is obviously my website, coreyrozenke.com. That's kind of that centralized point where you can learn more about me. There's even a spot in there you could contact me directly. There's links to my book, though I just put a few links in there. Ultimately, the book is available everywhere. But that'd be the best place. You could see me at Corey Rozenke Ministries on Facebook, CR Rozenke. On Twitter. Those would be the best places to contact me. Ultimately, though, Corey Rozenke is not an easy name to say or spell all the time. So if you're ever in a pinch, just type the Magnetic Heart of God or the Understanding the Five Cravings of Your Soul, and the book will pop up, and probably I will pop up as well somewhere. As I mentioned, the book is available everywhere. And so you shouldn't have a problem finding it.
Cool. And I'll link that in the description below as well, just in case people want to find you. And with that, Corey, thank you very much for this time. It's been very educational and insightful for me.
Drew, thank you so much.
If you like this episode, then make sure to like, share, subscribe, and leave a review. That will help me get to people just like you. Also, make sure to visit mlmpod.info. Keep acquiring knowledge, and I'll see you in the next episode.